This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Friday, but this week we're actually going to do a debate in review because seven Democratic candidates took the debate stage last night. That seems, frankly, kind of small after what we've been seeing, but it was enough people to give us a lot to cover. So let's dive right in. Joining me here in Studio 3 is former 10-term congressman from Massachusetts, Michael Capuano. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here again.
We're getting good at doing this together. Really looking forward to it. Seti Warren is also with us, currently executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Welcome back, Seti.
Great to see you.
We also have it's great to have you. We also have on the line Jane Swift, former Massachusetts governor. Governor Swift, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And we also have you, listeners. We want to hear from you. What did you make of last night's Democratic debate? Now that the field is winnowing and we're getting closer to the primaries, did you watch it? Did you hear anything that changed your mind about one of the candidates? What do you make of the party's approach to the 2020 campaign? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so there was a policy dimension to the debate last night. There was horse race dimension on display as well. I want to start with policy, and I'm going to start with the two former Democratic elected officials. So Mayor Warren and Congressman, what was new last night? Did you see anything new that you hadn't seen or that really stood out to you compared to the previous Democratic debates this year?
A little more feistiness, but that's to be expected as we get closer to an actual election. And it will probably be more feisty in January and February, too, as things get closer and people realize they need to do this, that, or the other thing before they'll do it. And that will be interesting.
How about you, Seti?
I don't think I saw anything new on the policy end. I think when I think about these debates, I think about a couple of things. First, and there are three. Two have to do with the debates. The third has to do with being outside of the debate. One, I think candidates, and I traveled with John Kerry in 2004. I was in Iowa quite a bit with him. One, do people actually think that that candidate is on their side and understand what they're going through day to day, their households going through day to day? Do they trust that? The second is, can they take a punch and hit back and push back? I think that is important. And you saw, as the congressman said, you saw some pushback, some feistiness. I think people want to see someone that can not just fight for them, but eventually take on Donald Trump. And the third is something that is not reflected in any of these debates, and that's what's going on the ground in Iowa. What is kind of organizing is happening? What kind of efforts are being made from the mechanics of a campaign? We've seen so many surprises coming out of Iowa because, as we know, the caucuses are different than a primary. If you're a caucus goer, you've got to get trained. You have to spend a day or longer in a room to support a particular candidate. So I think that – and we can't see that from here. So do I think these debates are important? Sure, I think they're important because of the first two points I made. But the third is just as important.
So I'm going to laugh and say, so nothing new then, really, from either of you. But I do want to bring in another perspective, too. Former Governor Jane Swift is joining us, kind of representing the other party on the other side of the aisle. Governor Swift, let me ask you, did you hear anything new or surprising or different last night from the previous debates?
Well, I think one of the things that was interesting to me, because I've been trying to figure out as a Republican who, frankly, could end up voting for a Democratic candidate if it's someone who is at least making a semblance of appeal to moderates like myself, is whether or not the candidates in this field and on the Democratic side of the aisle are running to vent and to sort of scream the loudest about their frustrations, or are they actually running to win? And I thought last night you heard a few candidates, in particular Amy Klobuchar, who emerged, and I think many people feel did herself a great deal of good on the stage after having been running pretty far back in the pack, who articulated a platform and did so in a powerful enough way that she, you know, made a case to voters that she could actually win the whole election, not just the Democratic nomination. And to me, that was one of the first times I know folks have articulated that Joe Biden is the candidate many Democrats feel could be a winning candidate. I think there are some flaws there.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. Mike's calling from West Tisbury. Mike, join the conversation. What do you want to say with the other panelists?
Well, actually, following Governor Swift's comments is what I was going to say. Senator Klobuchar was my choice going into all of this, and I sort of lost touch with her during some of the previous debates, but I thought she not only held her own last night, but also presented the clearest vision for the country that I've heard, as well as the most compelling case for why the current occupant of the White House ought to be impeached. And so, aside from some of the sparring that went on, I thought she did a terrific job, and I'm looking forward to seeing her do more of that in the upcoming debates, as well as hopefully do well in the upcoming primaries.
So let's build on that, Congressman, with what Mike was saying. One of the things that I wondered was, with fewer people on the stage, if you remember the first time you were in here this year and we were covering, we had two nights, 10 or 11 candidates a night, right? It was a lot to get
in.
Too much. Yeah, seven people last night for 2.5 hours. Was there room for the candidates to kind of breathe and expand?
To some extent, I think there was too much room. I think the debate was too long. I think they should have shortened it a little bit just for the purpose of getting attention from the average person. But yeah, I think so. I think there was absolutely room. Everybody had more time than they've had. I saw the numbers this morning, and I think Yang had the least. But even then, he was around 12 minutes, around that range. I'm not sure the number. And Klobuchar had was like 20 minutes, something like that. So they had plenty of time to at least be heard, not to formulate a full-blown, full-throated policy platform, but at least to be heard and to be measured. And I think that's the norm because of the size. I don't think anyone really damaged themselves last night. I think some people did themselves some good. I do agree that Amy Klobuchar did herself some good. Whether it'll be sufficient enough at this point in time, don't know. We'll find out probably within a week or two as polls start rolling out. I think Joe Biden did himself some good last night. I think Andrew Yang did himself some good last night, to my surprise, to some extent. But, and again, is that enough? I don't know. We'll find out. But I think not winners and losers. I don't think there were any losers, but I do think some people put themselves in a position to maybe enhance their current standing.
So, Maricetti Warren, one of the things that I found myself thinking while I was watching the debate last night, there were some subjects that came up that we heard Democrats really talk about that there hadn't seemed to be room to talk about before. So there was substantive discussion. Let's take foreign policy. We heard about Hong Kong. We heard about China. We heard about Israel. Now that we've got a smaller group, are we going to hear more policy discussion? And I don't want to sound glib, but does it matter? Is that a measuring stick that voters are using to think about who they want to pick?
So I'm glad you mentioned foreign policy. I'm a Iraq war veteran. I spent a year overseas, and I know how important the commander-in-chief's decisions are in regard to sending people overseas or not, relationships with allies. I certainly hope that foreign policy continues to be a prominent part of the discussion, policy discussion. That being said, do I think at this moment policy will decide exactly what's going to happen? No, not policy alone. I think it's a credential for the candidates. I think particularly in Iowa, when candidates are in Iowa, and I've spent a lot of time in Iowa, these caucus goers in New Hampshire as well, they get a chance to really drill down and want to understand what the candidate is thinking. I remember John Kerry being in VFW halls and living rooms and people diving, doing deep dives on exactly where they stand on particular issues. And I think he had some of his best performances in those spaces. But ultimately, I do think it does come down to, can I trust this person to be on my side when it matters? It's because not everyone's going to agree with every policy position a candidate has. It's all about that trust. And can they take a punch and can they push back and can they take on this president? I think those two things are going to be important.
Well, I'm going to turn to this calls now because the lines are filling up, which is great. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to pull up a chair at the table. We've got Joe calling. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I was very impressed with Andrew Yang. He was the only candidate who said, why are we talking about impeachment? Donald Trump is going to be on the ballot in November. That's what we got to talk about, is the vision for the voters out there. And his ideas are always unique, powerful, logically stated. And I think he's brilliant. And I think the idea of the freedom dividend, everybody getting $1,000 a month, is a wonderful idea. It will take care of a lot of people who take care of elderly or sick parents or children. They stay at home. There's no recognition for their value, and they have a tremendous value. And so I think he's brilliant, and I love his ideas. And I know the odds are so much against him, but he's still there.
That's great, Joe. Thanks. That was Joe from Woburn. And that gives an opportunity. We actually have some sound from Andrew Yang where he talks about what we need to be focused on to be effective in this race.
We blasted away 4 million manufacturing jobs that were primarily based in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri. I just left Iowa. We blasted 40,000 manufacturing jobs there. The more we act like Donald Trump is the cause of all of our problems, the more Americans lose trust that we can actually see what's going on in our communities and solve those problems.
So, Governor Jane Swift, there's Andrew Yang saying we are focused on the wrong things as America. We need to be focused on the loss of jobs, the, you know, the economic challenges. I'm curious, do you think that there were messages around things like the economy, foreign policy, as Mayor Cindy Warren was talking about, that are going to draw voters who are in the middle or maybe voters who are looking for an alternative to the Donald Trump that they voted for in the last election towards a Democratic candidate?
Well, I think as the last caller said, I think it's really important that whoever emerges have a very clear narrative. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, like him, dislike him, and I don't think actually those words are powerful enough to capture the feelings that he evokes in voters. There is not, I don't think, a person who doesn't know what his narrative is, right? He's, you know, make America great again, whether you think he has or whether you think he hasn't. People know who he is and what he stands for. And I think that Andrew Yang is a very intriguing candidate because he is just, he's different. And he's speaking very clearly about what he believes in. And I do think it has to be about what will you do for me? And again, this gets back to, are we venting or are we trying to talk about what the voters care about? I will also tell you that one of the things that I find really interesting about Andrew Yang is he's from Schenectady, New York. He's from more or less, I mean, I know folks maybe won't feel this way, but from Western Massachusetts, Schenectady feels like middle America, like one of those places that real people come from. It is an aging blue-collar industrial city and one that also had General Electric plants that closed down, like many of the cities that I represented, small New England cities that I represented in the Massachusetts Senate. So I think folks would be wise to listen to the ideas that Andrew Yang says and also how he is delivering his message.
Congressman, go ahead.
At the same time, I actually think policy does matter. I don't think it's going to be an intellectual debate. I think policy positions allow people to determine the things that Cindy was talking about earlier. That helps me determine whether I like that person, whether I think they actually see me. So for the sake of discussion, if we're going to talk about manufacturing, there was a major bill that was passed in the House just yesterday on trade with Mexico and Canada. I would like to know exactly whether the people on that stage are supportive or not supportive of that specific bill. And if so, why? And if so, if not, why not? Things like that. The generic commentary about I'm for this and I'm for that, that time is not over yet, but it's soon to be over in the sense of, okay, I've heard your platitudes. What specifically do you mean? Now, I give Yang credit on this $1,000. I don't think it's a good idea, but I also it's a specific idea. It has attracted some people. It is an interesting idea. I would like to hear more of that from people than this the generic stuff. And I think that, again, last night, it's pre-holiday, so I didn't expect a whole lot. But as we get into next year and getting close to the elections, I think the media is going to have to drill down a little bit more on specifics. Again, not for the sake of policy, so that people like me can determine, well, what do you mean when you say you care about American jobs? I need more detail. Everybody likes it. That's motherhood, apple pie, puppy dogs. We're all for that. What is
I
it
do
that,
like puppy dogs, I have to admit.
Well, good. Then maybe you can run for office, maybe even president. But to me, I think policy is a way to get to the final determination as to whether I like that person, whether I think that person empathizes with me. And I think right now, the differences in this crew have not yet been completely drawn out.
There was this interesting policy moment on economic policy that really caught my attention last night. And this was actually from Tom Steyer, who was talking about campaigning on economic growth versus just economic justice.
We know Mr. Trump's going to run on the economy. I built a business over 30 years from scratch. We're going to have to take him on the economy in terms of growth as well as economic justice. We're going to have to be able to talk about growth, prosperity across the board for everyone in America.
To me, that was an interesting moment in that there was a healthy debate about economic policy last night. It was largely focused on the very important issue of economic justice. But we did not hear as much in terms of concrete policy around economic growth for the country. Do you think, Mayor Seti Warren, that we're in need of a conversation about growth as a country in order to keep this economy strong and make it work for more of the American people?
Of course. Look, one of the things that came out of that debate last night, and a few of the candidates did this, I think the questioner said we have record low unemployment, we have jobs growth, we have GDP growth, we have stock market and all the rest. It was made clear, and I'm glad it was made clear, that those indicators don't actually show what's really happening underneath those numbers. The fact that people's wages have been stagnant, haven't matched the cost of living, the fact that people are hurting out there. And I think that the candidates outline that, but I think, Mike just mentioned this, to get to the next conversation, what specifically are you going to do with that scenario, right?
And that's kind of
the next step. I think that is the next step. And okay, the candidates have to be able to answer those questions.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. I'm asking everyone to stick around. Callers and listeners, stick around. Former Congressman Michael Capuano, former Mayor Seti Warren, former Governor Jane Swift, everybody stay with us. When we come back, let's talk a little more about the horse race and maybe even what the heck is a wine cave. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let us continue our local analysis of last night's Democratic presidential primary debate. Just a reminder, here with me in Studio 3 is former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano, former Newton Mayor Seti Warren, and then on the line with us is former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. Welcome back to all three of you.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Listeners, we want you to continue to join us as well. What did you think of the debate if you watched it? Hey, if you didn't watch it, why? When do you think you want to start tuning in to the 2020 presidential race? Are there particular policy issues that you're hankering for that you're not hearing or that you are now hearing and are finding more intriguing? Share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's actually lead off this segment with a caller. We've got Rebecca on the line from Newton. Rebecca, what's on your mind?
Hi, Seti and Jane. It's Rebecca Cantor. Thank you guys for having me on and taking the call. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the niche issues that I feel like come up in our debates over and over as Democrats that kind of distract from some of the more central topics around the economy and thinking about some of the guardrails removed post the Obama administration that could open up the opportunity for a new financial crisis to overcome America, thinking about education more than just talking about free college and tuition, but overhauling of the K-12 system to work alongside the future of work. So I wanted to hear your comments on how we shift the Dem Party to kind of stand in solidarity the way Republicans so beautifully have around laying out a new vision for the future that might actually win, as opposed to getting kind of caught up in where our money is coming from and kind of perpetuating the trend of losing.
So Rebecca has led off our second segment well. Seti Warren, you want to take a stab at that?
Rebecca, it's always great to hear from you. Look, at the end of the day, this is, Mike, you mentioned this, policies matter, right? What people say, not just what they're committed to do, but how they're going to get there matters. And I have to give Elizabeth Warren credit. Whether you like her plans or not, she is right now a candidate who's putting specific concrete policies in front of the public for debate, which is a risk, but also is setting the mark for a lot of the other candidates. But I'd like to see some of the other candidates describe how they're going to lift people out of poverty, how they're going to ensure that, as Rebecca mentioned, specifically we're going to move kids that are not doing so well in our public schools into a place where they are, how we're going to lift all public schools, not just the quality ones like they're in Newton, but all public schools, how we're going to create jobs. I think we need to get more specific, and I think the nominee, Rebecca, will set that tone, whether or not there's specific policies in place to give people opportunity or whether it's a little gauzy and hazy and we're talking about other distractions on the campaign trail.
I want to turn to Governor Jane Swift here, too, because the other thing that I sort of keyed in on, Governor, on Rebecca's question was her observation that Republicans are in lockstep with their leader, who is Donald Trump. I had not heard anybody raise the question of what it would take for Democrats to be in lockstep the same way Republicans are.
Well, I think, unfortunately, Democrats are in lockstep on education, and it's actually on this issue, I think that Elizabeth Warren is getting a little bit of trouble on that. So the Democrats are in lockstep on education with the teachers' unions, which isn't always consistent with what's in the best interest of their base. There's, if you look on Twitter, a lot of dissatisfaction, particularly among parents of color whose children are finding good educational choices through very successful charter schools, who have been trying to figure out why some candidates, particularly Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, have changed their position on being supportive of those charter schools who have demonstrated success in educating predominantly children in low-income communities, and now that they're running for president are no longer supporting those school choice and charter school issues. So I think they're actually, unfortunately, when you're in a political primary, people do march in lockstep, and it isn't always in the best interest of students. In the case of education, far too often the issues that are dictated by the adults who vote get the priority.
Let's grab another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rich is calling from Marblehead. Rich, what's on your mind?
Well, you were asking if people were paying much attention or, you know, watching the debates. To me, the difference between the two political platforms is it's 180 degrees. It's not a close. We're not talking about moderate Republicans here, to me. And some of the things are just go so against the pale of what I think our country should stand for that I don't need to really watch the debates to decide which Democratic Party candidate I'm going to support. If it's not Trump, that's the answer. And I'll be taking weeks off to campaign for whoever the nominee is. So it's not that I'm not interested. It's just that at the end of the day, it's, you know, part of this is a popularity contest and who can excite people to come to the polls.
Thank you for that, Rich. And I'm going to turn to the congressman for this because, all right, so on the one hand, we have people saying, just give me a candidate and I will vote for that person. You know, Rich just said, I will take weeks off to campaign for person X. We don't even know who that person is yet. On the other hand, if you listen to pundits and other conversations about the Democratic Party, there also seems to be this terrible concern that choosing the wrong candidate means losing to the current president. So how do we explain the, on the one hand, just give me anybody from Democrats, and on the other hand, Democrats saying, but got to get the right person or we're going to lose? How does one make sense of that?
I don't think you can. I don't think you should worry about it. This is called a primary. This is where, in a primary, it's a debate amongst the family as to which direction the family wants to go in. And it's usually about details, not big things. For instance, health care for all. We're not arguing whether everybody should have it. We're arguing how we get it. And that's what primaries do. By the time the primaries, actually, for instance, last night's debate was a little bit more substantive than the previous debates because there are fewer candidates. The next one might have fewer candidates. By the time we get down to a manageable number of candidates, we'll have more and more policy discussions, and eventually we'll have a nominee that will actually set that policy, those policies, and we will decide whether we follow it or not. Rebecca, who's looking for Democrats to fall in line, I'm sorry, Rebecca, Democrats never fall in line. We might fall in line against Donald Trump, but that will be temporary. On January 20th, we will then start fighting amongst ourselves again. But again, it won't be on the big issues. It'll be on how we get to those big issues. So for me, right now, I think we're actually pretty much where we should be. People are still testing this out. The gas is starting to get pressed down a little bit, so we're starting to go a little bit faster. After the holidays, it'll go a lot faster, and people will start paying more attention. So right now, I actually think things are working out reasonably well, and I do think that's a fair issue. I actually think that's the most important issue that's going through the primary right now. People are trying to determine, here's what I believe, who's the closest to that I also think can beat Donald Trump.
All right, so here, this gives us an interesting opportunity to go to the sort of meme moment of last night, but I don't want to go because of the meme. Nevertheless, the wine cave moment was kind of a meme moment. Here is Elizabeth Warren.
The mayor just recently had a fundraiser that was held in a wine cave full of crystals and served $900 a bottle wine. Think about who comes to that. He had promised that every fundraiser he would do would be open door, but this one was closed door. We made the decision many years ago that rich people in smoke-filled rooms would not pick the next president of the United States.
Now, that started a thumping good conversation, and at one point, Pete Buttigieg, she was referring to Pete Buttigieg, right? He had this to say in response.
We're in the fight of our lives right now. Donald Trump and his allies have made it abundantly clear that they will stop at nothing, not even foreign interference to hold on to power. They've already put together more than $300 million. This is our chance. This is our only chance to defeat Donald Trump. And we shouldn't try to do it with one hand tied behind our back.
So it seemed to me, Mayor Seti Warren, like there were two existential fights playing out at the same time there. The second one was the one we heard from Mayor Pete Buttigieg, which was sort of the Democrats are in the fight of their life against Donald Trump, and we need all the money on the table, all the weapons on the table, however you want to say that. But there also seemed to be a pretty substantive conversation happening among the candidates up there about fidelity to the little guy. And how everything from campaign finance to the policies that you choose, where you take your money, whether your donors are little donors or big donors or grassroots donors, that there was some really profound need to practice the campaign in a way that was consistent with this fidelity for the little guy. Yet that seems incredibly hard to do, as was modeled in that back and forth. So let me just take that big old mess and lay it in front of you and ask you what you might say about it.
Well, look, as someone who's, you know, run for local office, statewide office, I know how hard it is to raise money for any of these campaigns. At the end of the day, to me, the root of this is we need campaign finance reform. I believe in publicly financed campaigns. That's my opinion. I think that, you know, we all know survey after survey after survey, and there's real concerns about people who, you know, go into different offices that have interest and help to craft bills and on and have influence, and then they do fundraisers. So, but I do think this all comes down to the character of the candidate at the end of the day. Are they running? Why are they running for office? What do they want to do for people? Are they interested in the interests of the people that have given them money? Are they interested in doing the right thing? And I think that that is where the question lies. That and also we desperately need to reform the way these campaigns are financed.
Okay, so Congressman Capuano, I'm going to turn to you, but Governor Swift, heads up, I'm coming to you next on this.
Okay.
Congressman, if you were advising members of the Democratic Party or the party itself right now, would you say stay away from the, you know, the wine cave, the $1,000 event? So explain that.
If you can't survive a hit in a primary, you'll never survive against Donald Trump. This is a way to figure out if any hits, not just this, there'll be more on everybody. Whatever the hits are, I hope they all come out in the primaries. I don't want any surprises by Donald Trump after we get a nominee saying we never knew about this about our nominee. And this is a legitimate hit, but it was also a legitimate hit. His response to Elizabeth Warren was pretty legitimate as well. It's like, wait a minute, last year you were doing the exact same type of things, and everybody has some skeletons in their closet. Fundraising in politics is horrendous. There's really every single time we've had a so-called reform on campaign finance, we've ended up with more money and darker money into the campaigns. Every single time in my lifetime. I don't know how to fix it. I don't think there is a silver bullet. The concept of publicly finances is wonderful, except I hate the idea of my money going to Donald Trump. Or other candidates I don't like. I don't want my money going to candidates who I don't think can win. So there's a problem with that as well. I don't know the answer. I do know that whatever shortcomings a candidate has is best tested in the public light in a primary before we get to a final. People will then know all the shortcomings. We're human beings. Everybody on that stage has problems. Let's bring them out. Let's knock them around. Let's see if they can stand up to it. Let's see if they can do it in an adult, in a thoughtful way. Let's see what their reaction is. If they break down and cry or if they get angry, that's a problem. So for me, no, I don't have any problem whatsoever with raising every legitimate issue about every candidate as soon as we can.
Governor Swift, let me turn to you and ask you to pick up on this, especially, actually, I would welcome your reaction to any of what you just heard, but I'm also curious your perspective on the role that money is playing in campaigns and politics right now.
So I think it's unavoidable. You're going to have to raise money. And frankly, a lot of times raising money is all about testing your message and being a good candidate. So, and let's be clear, the people who have the greatest advantage are the people who are personally wealthy. And there's nothing you can do about that because the Constitution protects their advantage to free speech. So let's not, prevent other people who aren't wealthy from raising the money to be competitive. So I think, and it's generally the Democratic Party that makes a big deal about this and then fights over class warfare. And it's not a message, frankly, that appeals all that much to me. I think America is a place where we should be talking about how you let everybody have an opportunity, whether it's through education or the free market system, to get rich. But I can tell you this, I am not voting for anybody who's against wine.
Oh, excellent. I fully approve that message. The
governor's got a point on that.
So I'm going to use this moment to pivot a little bit. We have to talk about the other elephant that has not only been in the room but all over the news for the last couple of weeks, which is impeachment. It was interesting.
Do we
that
have
they,
to talk about
what,
it?
What, there, but I promise it's not the typical impeachment question. I have a question I've been dying to ask the three of you about this specifically, and I now have 3 minutes to do it. So let me. Last night there were three senators on the stage. The Democratic Party has been very upset about the way Republicans in the Senate have demonstrated that they're not interested in impartiality if impeachment makes it to the Senate. When the three senators standing on that stage, who will have to serve essentially as jurors in a trial-like event in the Senate, were asked to make the case for impeachment, not one of them said, "I'm about to have to be impartial. Yes, I have a record of comments on this. Please refer back to them. But in this moment, as a sitting U.S. senator, perhaps the appropriate thing for me to do is not comment because I'm about to have to at least present the appearance of impartiality." Am I just naive? Am I just hoping too much? Or was that a missed opportunity by any of the three sitting U.S. senators on the stage?
I don't think there's a single senator that doesn't know how they're voting already. And if there are maybe a handful, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Every other senator knows how they're voting already, like every member of the House, except for, again, maybe a handful of people who didn't make the decision till the end. This has been a rolling issue. This is not a new issue to anybody. No senator has lived under a rock for the last year. They know how they're voting, and they can pretend to be, or they can say all the right words. And if that makes you feel better, that's fine. But do you really think Mitch McConnell is neutral? No,
but I think part of it was if people are going to be so upset that he's pulling away the veil and being so naked about it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that would have been it would have been disingenuous for those candidates to say, "I'm stepping back, I'm impartial." They've been on the record talking about.
And let me be clear, I'm not saying that they should say they're impartial. They might say, maybe not the most appropriate moment for me to lay out my case.
Yeah, I think it would have come across as not being completely transparent.
Governor Swift, my last turn is to you.
I just think it's really difficult to criticize the Republicans by saying they need to be impartial and then say, but we've already made up our mind. So I agree with Congressman Capuano. They all know how they're voting, and to think otherwise, I think is naive at best. I think they should just take up the matter and take their votes and then go back and defend them to their constituents.
Okay, lightning round. Governor Swift, I'll start with you. One thing you're looking for before the first caucus in 8 weeks.
I am looking to see how folks are going to appeal to the swing voters, not the folks who are going to decide the Democratic Party, but who are going to decide the election.
Mayor Warren?
I want to hear Democratic candidates really speak to people's personal economy, what's going on in their lives, how they're going to make a living, how their kids are going to do better than them than they did. I really want to hear candidates articulate that in a way that's powerful.
Congressman?
I just want the caucuses to be over. I don't like caucuses. I think they're undemocratic, and they don't do much. I really want to get to Super Tuesday, maybe with a few trip-ups in New Hampshire and South Carolina. But in the meantime, I want to get to Super Tuesday. I think that'll be the first truly definitive day of this election cycle.
All right. So that was Congressman from Massachusetts, Michael Capuano. Thank you so much. Former Mayor Seti Warren from Newton, thank you so much. Former Governor Jane Swift, thank you. So believe it or not, we are actually headed to the wine cave after the break. We're going to talk about holiday cocktails. And Mayor Warren, Congressman Capuano, I think you're going to stick around and sip with me, yes?
Only if you have a $900 bottle.
There you go. Hey, listeners, stay tuned. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.